This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
There is a correlation between the dangers of video games and bullying with school shootings. And there's going to be a very special program in Porter County coming up on Monday, April 30th, to talk about that with two very special guests. And to find out all about this, we'll check in now with Porter County Sheriff David Reynolds. Sheriff Reynolds, thanks for being with us here on the program.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Well, first, let's talk here about the very serious nature of the issue. We are certainly aware of the problems with school shootings, the most recently, of course, happening in Florida, which has such a tragic ending. And of course, other concerns, too, of others that have happened around the country. And in particular, one that you're one of your guests coming up for the special program on April 30th is personally aware of. Tell us first here about the issue that you have in your concerns here in Porter County about this relationship between bullying and video games with what has happened in schools.
Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity. I'm involved in the Safe School Commission in Porter County, and what we've done a lot, we think, in the last 3 years to try to better protect our schools regarding an alert system, a one county, one protocol. We have actually posters that are in every school, public and private, all 75 schools, with the primary objective of teaching the students and teachers and administrators and employees what to do in case of an active shooter. But there's been a lot of discussion in the last year about looking at different factors that might even actually cause something like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously mental health is an issue that we have to deal with, but there is a foremost expert in school bullying and bullying in general and the violent video games. And this individual's name is Phil Chalmers. I've actually heard him speak. He's very dynamic. He's done a lot of research on all of the shootings, and there is some common denominators regarding some of these shootings. And so Phil Chalmers is one of our speakers on April 30th, and we're also very fortunate to have Frank DeAngelis. And Frank DeAngelis was the principal at Columbine High School when, I don't know if it was the first, but it was one of the first major school shootings that occurred that got everyone's attention on what not to do in a school shooting. So, and he's speaking for an hour. So we're really fortunate to have two very dynamic and national type speakers at this event on April 30th at Ivy Tech. It's from 5:30 to 8:30.
Now, how did you and members of the Safe Schools Committee manage to be able to get Mr. DeAngelis and Mr. Chalmers together at one particular spot to be able to talk to people?
Well, that's a great question. We have a school. We have the alert system that we chose 2.5 years ago is School Guard, and the owner of School Guard, we went through him to get a hold of both of these individuals that do work for him.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the nation, promoting this alert system. But I don't know if they're employees of School Guard, but that he made arrangements to fly them up. Then they paid for the flights, and then the Safe School Commission went out and got some sponsors to actually pay for them. So School Guard was very instrumental in getting these two individuals at our event on April 30th.
Now, you took a moment here and you already told us a little bit about Frank DeAngelis here, about his relationship, of course, with the problem, having been the principal there at Columbine High School during the problems that happened there back in April of 1999. And you've mentioned a little bit here about Phil Chalmers. What is his way that he's been able to be able to look into the mind of young people to be able to determine what kind of problems might lie there?
Well, he's wrote several books. One of the things he's done is interviewed many of these shooters.
Uh-huh.
He's researched You know, everything is like based on what evidence-based decision making now. That's kind of like the flavor of the day, so to speak, and which is, you know, very powerful. I mean, you base your decisions on the research that's done, and our thinking is that's all good. But if you've got someone who's already did the research and has learned from the research that he's done, then why shouldn't we, you know, kind of tap into that? Another person that we have had at Porter County is Lieutenant Colonel David Grossman, who's another school specialist, and he also has spoke in Porter County several times on school safety. So I think we're just really fortunate to tap into people like Frank DeAngelis and Phil Chalmers on what they have seen nationwide. And right now there's 350 seats available in this auditorium, which is a really nice auditorium in Ivy Tech. And I think we're close to 290 RSVPs.
Wow.
So if people are interested, yeah, they need to, you know, it's free, okay? So, but I don't think you'll be disappointed in spending a couple hours. We're really trying to get parents, administrators, teachers to this event. And so far, the people that are that have RSVP'd mostly are high school administrators and teachers from high school and college. Almost all of the universities in our immediate area will be there. So we're excited. And I think it's some education and training that they'll get that I think they'll find very powerful.
And it's probably safe to say that if parents want to attend this particular event coming up here on April 30th, that probably it's wise if they have young people, they ought to get grandma or grandpa come in and babysit, because they're not really, really welcome to tag along to this event. This is something for grown-ups only.
Right. Phil Chalmers does do a program for kids, and so does Frank DeAngelis for students.
Right,
but this is not the one. This is going to be focused for parents and grandparents. If grandparents are raising their children, they need to understand what's going on. And you know, I talked to a supervisor for U.S. Steel, and their U.S. Steel is going to attend. And you know, bullying if you're bullying in grade school and middle school and high school, and then you get a job somewhere, I don't think you stop being a bully.
Yeah.
But what we're finding is, you know, and there's mental health issues that come into this play too. But what they're going to find out is they're going to get better information on how to identify a bully and what to do about it.
I can imagine that this is very important. As you mentioned about the fact that we have one of our local industries interested in having somebody attend to learn something about the problem, because as you mentioned, a bully is still going to be a bully, whether it's a young person or a grown up here. And I suppose that can lead to a lot of problems in the workplace if it's not captured ahead of time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we're really we're real pleased on the response we're getting.
That's great.
And I appreciate the fact that you're going to broadcast this too. That's good.
Well, I know that we'd let people know this, particularly if they are interested in attending this event on April 30th, which is, again, it's going to happen at Ivy Tech Community College in Valparaiso. Get your seating arranged here by and how do you do that, by the way, too, if somebody is interested, for what limited seats that are left?
Yeah, you could call 477-3112 or email jbacknick at porter-ps.org. Mm-hmm. And just leave a message for Jordina, who's my administrative assistant, and she's controlling coordinating the seating arrangements. But you need to call the sheriff's department as soon as you can. if you're interested.
That's great. Sheriff Reynolds, we talked here a little bit here just briefly about the Porter County Safe Schools Commission. You've told us a little bit about the organization and the fact that they are working very hard with organizations around the Porter County in particular and branching out as well, too, especially with this particular event coming up on April 30th. What other activities does the Safe Schools Commission have planned or any more discussions like this one coming up?
Well, we don't have, we're working on a lot of policies. You know, since we have seven school districts, we're dealing with a lot of important issues regarding school safety. But we're going to, I think what we'll see is the response is going to be so good. We're actually entertaining the thought of bringing back Lieutenant David Grossman back. And there are a lot of foremost experts in the field. I think Porter County, we worked real hard trying to keep it very transparent and cooperative and collaborative to all the school systems, both private and public. And I think it's a testament to who shows up at our meetings. We have everyone shows up. We have 40, 50 people show up once a month to discuss issues like this and discuss, you know, how best to access CCTV cameras and how best to get into the schools if the schools are locked. And so we are doing a lot of things, but we're doing it together, you know, so all seven districts have to agree to it. And really, I can't say enough about the superintendents. They've been remarkable as far as being collaborative and cooperative and working towards the end of the goal of keeping the students and all of the employees in these schools safe.
Porter County Sheriff David Reynolds, thank you very much for spending time with us to tell us about this very important event coming up on April 30th. And people get their opportunities to attend this, do so right away. And we hope to hear back later that you've gotten some good response from people who have attended and certainly taken something away. Not only it's an eye-opening event to be sure of what they're going to no doubt see and hear, but something they can remember, they can put to use here, as you say, to try to make the schools all across Porter County and across Northwest Indiana, for that matter, much, much safer. Thank you for being with us to talk about it.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for the opportunity.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Air quality continues to be a concern here in Lake and in Porter counties. And Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson spoke with Angela Tin. She's the Vice President of Environmental Health for the American Lung Association about the annual State of the Air Address report and where the region seems to rank in it. Here's Angela Tin.
What we do is for the past 19 years, we have put out the State of the Air report. And the State of the Air report collects data from monitors run and operated by the state environmental protection agencies. And so all this data is downloaded into a computer, and we take the data and we evaluate the data, and we've been looking at it for the past 19 years to determine county by county what the air quality is in regards to ozone and particulate matter.
So in Northwest Indiana, how is the air quality, and what's the best and the worst counties?
Okay, if I'm looking at the numbers here, they list them by county, and I'm trying to figure out if the worst and the best. So the report is organized, Sharon, by people at risk, you know, throughout the United States, and it goes by every single county in the United States, and then they rank it by the cleanest cities to the dirtiest cities, and they go for each state, they list each state and each county in particular. Lake County had 10 ozone days in the three-year period between 2014 and 2016. And ozone is a combination of high temperature and pollutants mixing and causing low-level ozone. And because of these 10 days that occurred during the past 3 years, it received an F as far as ozone. Also, as far as particulate matter, it received also an F for the 2.5 particulate matter.
And what determines an A, B, C, D, or F?
So that is the classification that we've been using. And so both us and the state environmental protection agencies, they looked at a three-year period. And over the three-year period, if there are a number of exceedances during that period, using a weighted average, they assign a grade. So Lake County, for example, had four days of exceedances in the orange area.
What about Porter County and LaPorte County?
Yeah, Porter County is a little worse than Lake County because it had 12 days of exceedances in the orange area. And, you know, there's this different colors, orange and red and purple as being the worst. And it had 12 days of exceedances in the orange area and about 2-3 days of exceedances of PM. And so it received a C as far as particulate matter.
Isn't an F worse than a C?
Yes, ma'am. F is worse than a C, so the ozone was worse in Porter County than it was in for particulate matter. And remember, ozone is dependent on warm temperatures, and particulate matter is just, you know, it's just going to occur regardless of the temperature. So what that means is that there must have been, you know, a certain number of warm days and high pollution.
Would there be any way to tell how Northwest Indiana's air quality compared to the rest of the state?
I don't have that data in front of me, but there is county by county in our report. So you could look at the counties, all the individual counties, and then determine which are in the Northwest Indiana and then compare them to the others. So it can be done, but that's not a general way that's done in these reports. So every state in the United States has a state environmental protection agency that coordinates with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And so every state has monitors. And there's not enough monitors in every location, but there are monitors. And some of these used to be high monitors because we used to collect data from smokestacks. And nowadays, we have both high and low-level monitors. And so they're collecting information on a daily basis from these monitors. And the engineers from the state environmental protection agencies goes and collects the data, and then they put them into a computer, which is sent to US EPA, and that's the data that we use. Sometimes, you know, you have to be careful because, you know, there's not a monitor in a particular area, and that doesn't mean that there is or is not a problem. It's just that there wasn't, you know, enough monitors to go around.
Would you happen to know what the biggest polluters of air in Northwest Indiana are?
Right now, you know, a lot of the concerns we have, most of the concerns we have in most states, whether rural or urban, is mobile source pollution. And that's the pollution that's coming from, you know, the diesel trucks, the cars we drive, the trains, the buses, the barges, the airplanes. And mobile sources are one of the biggest concern. And that's why whether you live in a big city or a small city, you've got a lot of stop-and-go traffic. And you've got emissions coming from these vehicles.
That's the biggest source, you think, mobile source?
Yes. Generally across the United States, 40 to 70% of air pollution is mobile sources, transportation sources.
There's a lot of factories here in Northwest Indiana.
Yes. There's a lot of factories, and there's a lot of stacks. And every one of those factories and stacks, or even air pollution sources that are area sources, like, for example, a gas station, they're regulated by the State Environmental Protection Agency. So they have limits that they have to meet. And so, you know, there is compliance and enforcement efforts by the State Environmental Protection Agencies to go out and make sure that these factories comply.
Oh, by not putting too much pollution in the air, they give them like a cap?
Yes, there's an actual numerical number that they have to meet, whether it comes out of the stack or whether it comes out of, you know, a dry cleaner or a gas station. And so they have permits. And so every one of these people have permits that they have to meet, and they have numerical limits, and they have to send in reports that shows that they are below these limits.
You mentioned it before, but what type of pollution does Northwest Indiana suffer from the most? You said it was mobile emissions?
Mobile source emissions, yes, or transportation emissions. They're called transportations. And, you know, even sometimes, like, for example, Sharon, if a car, you know, it's not being driven, it's just sitting there in a parking lot, you go there, you can smell, you know, you can smell the gasoline. Or even go into a gas station, you can smell the gasoline. Those are the emissions that are coming out. What that is usually toxics like benzene that's coming out of the gasoline, and benzene is a carcinogen. These are chemicals. They're called VOCs, volatile organic chemicals, and that's what you're smelling is generally the benzene or the xylene, which are a component of gasoline. Gasoline is over 200 different components. Now, the particulates are come out as a result of combustion. So as that engine is driving or as that boat is moving or the bus is moving, the combustion process causes the particulates to come out the tailpipe. Now, cars are 95% cleaner than they used to be. However, there's still a lot of old cars out on the road.
And what's in particulates?
Particulate is what you said, the soot. And there's different types of soot. Factory soot, for example, is usually big particles. And so the soot comes in and your nose and your throat, you do a good job removing it from the body. You know, you swallow it and you get rid of it, or you cough it out and you get rid of it. But the fine soot, the very fine soot, which is about 2.5 micron, that's what gets deep into your lungs. And as it gets deep into the lungs, it combines and goes into the bloodstream. And that's the concern, is the small 2.5 micron soot.
What about the health effects of the bad air quality? Can you describe that and how that is in Northwest Indiana?
Yes. So what happens is that we have babies and we have youngsters, and their lungs, they breathe a lot faster than we do. And their lungs are growing. So as their lungs are breathing in faster, they're taking in more and more of that pollution, and their lungs don't develop. And so they don't have the capacity that a normal adult would have. Older people, at the same time, their lung capacity is quite limited, and so they're impacted by, you know, the pollution. And even healthy people that are just like outside workers or even a marathon runner is impacted by the pollution, because as he's running, he's breathing in the material. And lastly, environmental justice areas, poor people that live in neighborhoods with the highways and the trains, congestion, they can't get away from that area.
Would you happen to know the amount of population in Northwest Indiana that suffers from lung disease? Sure. Thanks.
Hold on, let me look. Let me look at my tables. Indiana, you said Lake County, okay?
Yes.
Okay, Lake County has a population of 485,000 people, okay? From this group, I have different numbers, but 9,565 have pediatric asthma, 37,000 have adult asthma, 30,000 have COPD, 38,000 has cardiovascular disease, 43,000 have diabetes, and 79,000 live in poverty areas. Porter County has a population of 167,000, of which 3,000 have pediatric asthma, 13,000 has adult asthma, 10,000 has COPD, 117 has lung cancer, 13,000 has cardiovascular disease, 15,000 has diabetes, and 12,000 live in poverty areas. The number one question we get, you know, Sharon, is, you know, what can I do? You know, we know there's a problem. You know, it may or may not be getting better each year. What can I do? So a number of things that people can do, especially on these high ozone days, you know, the orange days, the red days, mm-hmm. is listen to the alerts, perhaps take, public transportation into the offices, perhaps stay at home and work. Don't run lawnmowers, small equipment, or combustion devices. You know, don't be running outside. So pay attention to the environment and then, you know, protect yourself.
What is the solution to this problem of environmental pollution, air pollution?
If it is the mobile transportation sources, and this is the data we've had from, you know, whether it's our data or US EPA data, that it is mobile transportation sources, U.S. EPA has done a lot to clean up these vehicles, you know, so cars, trucks, boats, planes are cleaner than they were, you know, 20 years ago, and they continue to raise the standards for these vehicles. So as the cars are getting cleaner, there's only one other thing we can do, and that's improve the fuel that's being used in these cars. So whether it's electric vehicles or ethanol-based fuel or biodiesel-based fuel or propane, CNG, some other type of fuel besides the petroleum fuels would go a long way.
especially with climate change pollutants like CO2.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate
You're very welcome.
That's Angela Tin from the American Lung Association talking with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson about air quality here in Northwest Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Stratford Festival, which is, of course, one of the great theatrical festivals in North America, is underway once again this year. A lot of people here in Northwest Indiana and the Chicagoland area are very interested in what happens over at Stratford, Ontario this time of year. And a lot of great programs are on the schedule for 2018 there at the Stratford Festival. We have Ed Swerdfaker, who is the publicity director for the Stratford Festival, with us. And thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, a pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
Well, first, give us a little history lesson. The Stratford Festival goes back quite a ways.
It does. This is our 66th season. We were founded back in 1953, and it was actually a remarkable sequence of events that led to the festival being founded. Stratford had lost its main industry, which was rail repair, with the switch from steam to diesel, and people were thinking, what's next? Are we going to become a ghost town? And a hometown boy, Tom Patterson, came up with this idea of a Shakespeare festival. Sounded kind of crazy. Who would think that a Shakespeare festival could save an economy in a town? But it happened to be exactly the right answer. This year, we are actually welcoming our 28 millionth patron.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely unbelievable. The festival now generates almost $140 million every year into the local economy, and we welcome people from every state in the U.S., every province in Canada, and from countries around the world. 500,000 people come every single year, and about a quarter of those are coming from the U.S.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And on top of that, too, I know that there are many, many people here in Northwest Indiana and the Chicago area that have banded together into an association with the Stratford Festival, and they make regular pilgrimages over to Ontario to be able to catch the programs every year.
Absolutely. We love our Chicago associates, as they're called. They've been around for many years. They do make special trips up to Stratford. We make the festival key people from Stratford make trips down to Chicago every year for a fundraiser.
Mm-hmm.
There's been an agreement about training of actors that began over 20 years ago, and every year someone from Chicago comes to learn from the coaches here in Stratford or to be a member of our conservatory. They're called the Chicago Fellow, and they're funded through the Chicago Associates.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea began with the thought that, you know, we have this tremendous resource here, a classical theater company second to none in the world. And the folks in Chicago just thought, what an opportunity to have actors there come, learn from the coaches and other actors here, and then take those skills back to Chicago and share them there. We did start doing other programming in our very second season, 1954, when we started doing a Greek tragedy. And musicals were added, a little bit of Gilbert and Sullivan, some opera here and there. But as of 1986, we put the first musical on that Stratford Festival Theater stage.
Mm-hmm.
That stage was the first open or thrust theater of the modern era. It was absolutely revolutionary when it was built first in 1953, changed the way classical theater was presented. And in 1986, it changed the way musicals were presented. And that's why people come, not just to see our incredible classical productions, but to see musicals like they've never seen them before in an intimate theater. While it's huge, it seats 1,800 people, the festival theater has nobody further from the stage than 55 feet. And it is wrapped around the stage three quarters of the way around, and it allows for an intimate experience like you've never experienced in the theater before. That's why people keep coming back.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to see a musical or a play on a proscenium arch, which is the usual picture box theater that we're all used to, but to be wrapped around the audience presenting a musical, to be that close to the unbelievable dance moves, to see the tenderness of the love stories in these musicals is really incredible. And the same thing with the Shakespeare's. You get to feel every emotion. You get to see the expressions on their face so clearly. The costumes are so incredible. The staging is magnificent, and you don't get it anywhere else in the world. A few theaters have copied it. It's a very, in the 1950s, everyone thought, wow, this is magnificent. And there, the Vivian Beaumont in New York City, for instance, copied it, and the Guthrie in Minneapolis. But there aren't very many stages like this, and none of them are doing musicals on them.
Amazing. Amazing. What are we expecting to see for the 2018 season there at Stratford this year?
We have some really incredible event theater this year. The key Shakespeare is The Tempest, directed by our artistic director, Anthony Cimolino, and it is starring Martha Henry, one of the great classical actors in Canada, North America, performing now. She is one of our more senior actors. She just had her 80th birthday, actually, and she will be playing Prospero. This is something you're not going to want to miss. This is a culminating role for a classical actor. It's Shakespeare's last play. Anthony is an incredible director of Shakespeare. Obviously, he's the head of the festival here. That is going to be something people are not going to want to miss. And the polar opposite of that is Robert Lepage, who is a Canadian director, but of course renowned around the world, is directing Coriolanus for us over at the Avon Theater. And this is like watching an epic film, but live. There are projections, and it's incredible. It's a visual experience like you've never had in live theater before. So those are two key Shakespeares. We have more, of course, on the playbill. We also have our fabulous musicals this year, too. Again, polar opposites. We have The Music Man, and I truly believe this is one of the best evenings you'll have ever in the theater. Darren Herbert is starring as Harold Hill. Danielle Wade is playing Marion Peru. The dancers are unbelievable, and it's being directed and choreographed by Donna Fior, who has done one incredible hit after another for us. Don't want to jinx her there. I'm touching a little wood, but I know this show, I'd seen it already in dress rehearsal and preview, and it is exceptional.
Wow.
And at the same time, which has never been done anywhere in the world that I can find, Donna Fior is directing and choreographing the Rocky Horror Show on the Avon stage, directing and choreographing two major musicals, cross-cast, at the same time. This is something that has never happened in the theater, and it is absolutely incredible. Rocky Horror, as you know, is one of those cult hits.
Oh, yes.
And it is crazy and crass and absolutely spectacular. The dancing, the design, again, the projections, the set. It's really off the charts. And two incredibly different experiences, just like the two incredibly different Shakespeare experiences. And one of the joys of coming to Stratford, of course, is that we're a repertory theater. So everything's being produced to the same incredibly high standard. You get to see actors in very different roles at, on the same day even. You can see them in a musical one night, a Shakespeare the next afternoon. It's really quite an experience. I know that the New York Times has written about that often, the dizzying abundance of theater to be had in a few days in Stratford. And I really believe that's why people come from your area and from across the U.S. to spend some time in Stratford. They don't get that experience anywhere else. A, they don't get the classical theater performed to that standard. B, they don't get the rare classics performed. And C, they don't have the fun of the musicals, the comedies, and watching the actors do what they do in very different productions.
We only just have a limited time. Unfortunately, you could spend hours, I suppose, to talk about all of the performances, even for a single season. And if you'd like to find out more about the 2018 season for the Stratford Festival, you can go online to Stratford Festival. pardon me, Stratford Theater. No, I was right.
Stratfordfestival.ca.
Stratfordfestival.ca is the website that you can go to, and you can take a look at all the great shows that are up there. You can line up your tickets and all. You can line up, in fact, if you want to spend a few days in Stratford and the vicinity, you can line up beds and breakfasts if you like. Find out where you can stay, as well as all the great shows you're going to be able to attend there by going to the 2018 Stratford Festival this year, and find out more. Again, it's Stratford Festival, oneword.ca is the website, and get all the information that you need to spend an entire week at Stratford, Ontario, if you choose to do so, as many people have over the years, and catching the great performances there. And I have to ask the question, Anne, while I have you here to talk, I know that there's a great proliferation of scripts and plays out there to be able to take up, and we know the Stratford Festival has been able to focus on such great performances as from Gilbert and Sullivan. There's so many things I know that come up before everybody decide what the season is going to look like. Is there any chance that we might see some Gilbert and Sullivan coming back to Stratford in the years ahead?
You never know. We had one last year and a couple of years before that, I guess. It's always a surprise to those of us who work here when things come up. Of course, rights issues are involved in a lot of musicals, so Gilbert Sullivan, like Shakespeare, you don't have to worry about rights, but then there's other times when you want to grab the rights for bigger shows. And I want to say one other thing.
Yes.
Stratford's absolutely beautiful. An incredible community, gorgeous river running through town, a lovely, peaceful atmosphere when you leave the theater, so you get to really think about what you've seen and enjoy nature, soak up the ambiance, and we have unbelievable restaurants, so you get to eat like you've never eaten before.
Now, I've had the opportunity to do that, to spend some time sitting out there outdoors after a performance, waiting for the next one to come up, and a chance to catch some of the great restaurants in the area, too. So it's definitely worth spending a few days in Stratford and having an opportunity to just take your time and catch the performances you get, the wide range you can see from the different repertories that are available as well, too. Anne Swerdfaker is the Publicity Director for the Stratford Festival in Stratford, Ontario. And thank you for spending time with us back here in the States. We appreciate it, and we're looking forward to some of the great shows that are coming up on the Playbill for 2018.
Thank you so much.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem-solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. Soundbites is now sponsored by JP Morgan Chase. Do you ever wish you could go back in time? You're not alone. While time travel is not yet a viable option, one Indiana professor is living out his dreams of going back in time. Back to ancient Rome, to be exact. A lot of us love imagining life in the past, but Dr. Bernard Fisher doesn't have to imagine it. He can observe it himself. No, it's not time travel exactly, but it's as close as technology can get us. It's called archaeoinformatics. Dr. Fisher, better known as Bernie, is the director of Virtual World Heritage Lab at Indiana University, which is just one of the many innovative projects in the informatics school on Indiana University's Bloomington campus. IU's informatics program is a nationally ranked program for people who utilize cutting-edge technologies to solve real-world problems. There are many different kinds of informatics based on the kinds of problems somebody is using technology to solve. Bioinformatics uses technology to solve problems in the field of biology. And internet security informatics uses cutting-edge technology to solve digital security problems. Bernie's field is archaeoinformatics. He uses the latest technologies on the market to solve exciting problems in archaeology. Archaeoinformatics allows Bernie to infer how things may have looked in the past by creating 3D models of those places or those pieces of art and sharing them for free on the internet. Bringing that kind of information to the average person allows us all to see what homes looked like and where people gathered in ancient Rome. Observing these spaces gives us huge clues as to how people lived and what they valued at that time. These things are the closest we have to observing ancient Rome ourselves. For his personal business, Rome Reborn, Bernie and his team created 3D models to discover the purpose of two monuments in Rome that were placed there in the first century. In order to do this, Bernie used computational equations to figure out the monument's initial placement. Then by imitating the rise and fall of the sun, Bernie and his team were able to simulate the movement of the sun, which shed light on the meaning of these sculptures to the Romans.
Suddenly the whole thing made sense, and there, you know, shivers went up and down everybody's spine. And nobody ever suspected it, because nobody ever was able to do that time travel and go back to Rome, move the dials on the sun and the sky, and, you know, just stand in the virtual landscape and make observations.
It was Bernie's innovative spirit and passion for digital archaeology that created the Virtual Heritage Lab and inspired the department at IU. Now, the IU Informatics Department enables Bernie to continue to work on new projects, like the digitization of the entire collection of the Uffizi Museum in Italy that has more than 1,250 ancient statues. By digitizing the collection, Bernie and IU hope to give as many people access to the 3D images as possible, no matter where they are in the world. Bernie thinks of each piece of art, monument, and city as clues about the past. The more people who have access to each clue, the more well-developed the theories of historians, archaeologists, and scientists will be. Throughout his life, Bernie always attempted to combine his love for the arts and his fascination with technology. As a young man, he experimented with electronic music, filmmaking, philosophy, and many other things before combining archaeology and technology to create the Virtual Heritage Lab. For example, in the 1980s, he was one of the first people to run out and buy a personal computer, and one of the first people to have access to the internet, which at the time you had to sign up for through the Pentagon.
And my colleagues thought that this was some kind of a phase I was going through, and a passing hobby that I would outgrow and I'd get back to doing the research and thinking that they hired me to do in the mid-70s. But instead, it only got worse.
Luckily for us, his willingness to combine the STEM and humanities has pushed the fields of archaeology, technology, and history to new heights. And most importantly, have allowed the students of Indiana and beyond the unique opportunity to work under the leading innovator in this field. The Virtual Heritage Lab is just one fascinating example of the innovative work being done on informatics at Indiana University. Check out their website for more information. And tune in next week for a different story of Hoosier innovation. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by J.P. Morgan Chase, and I'm Sandra Burton.
Indiana's three Republican U.S. Senate candidates, Congressman Luke Messer and Todd Rokita and businessman Mike Braun, will meet this evening for the final debate before the May 8th primary election. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the controversy that swirled around the event hosted by the nonpartisan Indiana Debate Commission.
Last month, Congressman Todd Rokita said no to the Indiana Debate Commission. Commission President Jerry Linowska says he was surprised.
And disappointed, of course. You know, this is the first time that's happened in our 10 years of doing debates.
Earlier this month, Rokita did an about-face, opting to join the debate, but he had harsh words for its moderator, Abdul Hakim Shabazz. Linowska says he's confused by that. The debate's questions come almost entirely from the public.
The moderator's role is to keep the candidates on track, sort of keep the trains running, and ask follow-up questions closely related to the questions from the public.
Linowska says he's hoping for a substantive debate focused on policy issues, not personal attacks. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
Indiana University researchers are advising the talk should begin now on how to deal with settlements that could come from lawsuits filed by city and county bodies against opioid manufacturers and distributors. The recommendation came in a report that was released last week as part of the Grand Challenges Initiative at IU. The research is one of 16 projects launched in January. The university partnered with the state and invested $50 million into researching addiction. The recommendations offer insight about how policy affects the opioid crisis. Project lead Nicholas Terry says that when it comes to these lawsuits, the settlement money should go to programs combating addictions or those who are affected by the epidemic.
But it's very important that we have an early discussion about making sure that these monies, or a very large proportion of them, go towards those purposes and not just into sort of general budget piles.
The report also advises improving the availability of overdose reversal drugs like naloxone and services like syringe exchanges. The researchers say that these preliminary findings will be shared among policy and other decision makers to guide any future legislation and actions that might be tied to curbing the opioid epidemic. IU is currently accepting research proposals for Phase 2 of its Grand Challenges initiative. And according to the reports from the U.S. Department of Education, they've turned down Indiana's request to count thousands of the state's most basic high school diplomas that are known as general diplomas. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle reports on the impact to the state.
The new federal education law, Every Student Succeeds Act, requires states to report graduation rates in a uniform manner. The rule change means Indiana's least rigorous diploma, the general diploma, no longer counts in graduation rates. This week, the federal department denied Indiana's waiver from the rule. But Indiana Department of Education spokesman Adam Baker says the state won't face a negative impact.
I will pat ourselves on the back and our legislators on the back and say that there would be, had we not stepped in working together at the General Assembly, to only have this sort of one-year like break.
A law passed this year will soon combine Indiana's four diplomas into a single diploma, satisfying the federal law. But without the waiver, about 8,000 diplomas won't be counted when federal graduation data is released next month. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
It's time for another edition of Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Jane Lohmeyer, who is one of the founders of a program called All About Art. And All About Art takes place at Valparaiso University?
Yes, we are on the campus of Valparaiso University in one of the art studios.
And this is a summer program?
Yes.
And it's a summer camp program for what ages?
For basically students grades 3 through 5, but we have introduced some newer programs that we encourage junior high students to attend also. So we're expanding. Every year we do something a little bit different.
And how did you get All About Art started? How and when?
We started in 2003. It was a suggestion made by a graduate of the university who had started a program in another state. Mm-hmm. And she brought her program to us and presented it to us. And we were called in by the art department at the university to hear this presentation. And so the three of us, my other two partners, had been non-traditional students of mine at the university, and we all got together and did it.
Was it called All About Art in the other state as well?
No. I don't even remember what the name of her program was.
So how long does the camp run?
Each camp runs for 1 week, and we have one camp in the morning from 9 to 12, and then a different camp in the afternoon from 1 to 4. We have a 2D camp, a 3D camp. This year we have a new camp called 2D 3D, so it's a mixture of both. We have a digital camp. We have an advanced camp for previous attendees, and mm-hmm. then we have a special needs camp.
And each one runs for a week, you said?
Yes.
So, and what months are we talking about?
This happens in June. This is going to be the middle of June this year.
Okay.
We have lately been running into problems doing it right after school gets out because of snow days having to be made up.
Oh,
so
right.
We have moved it 1 week later.
Yeah. And then all the way through the end of August?
No, or? We'll be doing 2 weeks in June.
Oh, boy, that's intensive for all that you described, all that you listed, I mean.
Yes, it is.
You must keep really busy those 2 weeks.
Well, one of our partners and main teachers travels to the Middle East where her daughter lives, so mm-hmm. We kind of work around
you
that.
You have to.
Yeah.
You have to work it out. So about how many kids participate per year?
We have between 80 and 100.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Are they primarily Porter County residents, or do they come from
Yes, it is primarily Porter County, because we founded the camp because there was, at that time, no offering like it in mm-hmm. Porter County. So we decided that this was a need that right. needed to be filled.
Yeah. We'd like there to be a need.
Yes.
And for people to fill it. That's the whole point.
Right.
And anything new this year? How has it evolved over the years you've been doing it?
Oh, we started as a three-day camp, and it was all day long for 3 days.
Uh-huh.
And the people thought that that was just too long. So
3 days?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we went to half a day, you know, for a full week.
Yeah.
And that just seemed to appeal to people more. And we found grant funding and everything, just people thought that was a better yeah. model to follow. And we've added different, you know, we started with just 2D and 3D, and uh-huh. then we added digital, we added mm-hmm. advanced, we added special needs.
So this is your 15th year?
Yes.
2003, I did the math correctly, didn't I?
16th year. This 16th will be our 16th
year. Yeah,
year.
Well, right.
Yes.
So that math doesn't work out when it's an annual thing.
Right.
I know that. I know that trick. But so what is there something new on the horizon for the summer?
Just the 2D, 3D mixed camp.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
You had already. Well, it's for the indecisive, I was thinking when you said it. For the indecisive student
yeah.
who doesn't know what he or she likes best.
Right. Well, you know, and there are some that are very focused at that age and some that, you know, are just like, I just like to do art.
Yeah, sure. No, that's good. You're giving them an opportunity
sure.
to explore further their mm-hmm. creativity and their talent.
Yes.
Well, that's you're a good person, Jane, and a good advocate for the arts. Well, thank you for being here to tell us about All About Art, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
And if you happen to miss any portion of this conversation and any previous editions of Eye on the Arts, for that matter, you can go to our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, and get it there. And be sure to tune in next Monday at this time for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us.